At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only 10 bucks every day. Now that's finger-lickin' good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
Chapter 10 of The Valley of Silent Men. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Roger Moline. The Valley of Silent Men by James Oliver Curwood. Chapter 10. What a terrible and inexcusable madness had possessed him, Kent realized the instant he rose from Mercer's prostrate body. Never had his brain flamed to that madness before. He believed at first that he had killed Mercer. It was neither pity nor regret that brought him to his senses. Mercer, a coward and a traitor, a sneak of the lowest type, had no excuse for living. It was the thought that he had lost his chance to reach the river that cleared his head as he swayed over Mercer. He heard running feet. He saw figures approaching swiftly through the starlight, and he was too weak to fight or run. The little strength he had saved up, and which he had planned to use so carefully in his flight, was gone. His wound, weeks in bed, muscles unaccustomed to the terrific exertion he had made in these moments of his vengeance, left him now panting and swaying as the running footsteps came nearer. His head swam. For a space he was sickeningly dizzy, and in the first moment of that dizziness, when every drop of blood in his body seemed rushing to his brain, his vision was twisted and his sense of direction gone. In his rage he had overexerted himself. He knew that something had gone wrong inside him, and that he was helpless. Even then his impulse was to stagger toward the inanimate Mercer and kick him. But hands caught him and held him. He heard an amazed voice, then another, and something hard and cold shut around his wrists like a pair of toothless jaws. It was Constable Carter, Inspector Kedsty's right-hand man about barracks, that he saw first, then old Sands, the caretaker at Cardigan's place. Swiftly as he had turned sick, his brain grew clear, and his blood distributed itself evenly again through his body. He held up his hands. Carter had slipped a pair of irons on him, and the starlight glinted on the shining steel. Sands was bending over Mercer, and Carter was saying in a low voice, "It's too bad, Kent, but I've got to do it. I saw you from the window just as Mercer screamed. Why did you stop for him?" Mercer was getting up with the assistance of Sands. He turned a bloated and unseeing face toward Kent and Carter. He was blubbering and moaning, as though entreating for mercy in the fear that Kent had not finished with him. Carter pulled Kent away. "There's only one thing for me to do now," he said. "It isn't pleasant, but the law says I must take you to barracks." In the sky Kent saw the stars clearly again, and his lungs were drinking in the cool air as in the wonderful moments before his encounter with Mercer. He had lost, and it was Mercer who had made him lose. Carter felt the sudden tightening of his muscles as he walked with a hand on his arm, and Kent shut his teeth close and made no answer to what Carter had said, except that Carter heard something which he thought was a sob choked to death in the other's throat. Carter, too, was a man bred of the red blood of the North, and he knew what was in Kent's heart. For only by the breadth of a hair had Kent failed in his flight. Pelly was on duty at barracks, and it was Pelly who locked him in one of the three cells behind the detachment office. When he was gone, Kent sat down on the edge of his prison cot, and for the first time let the agony of his despair escape in a gasping breath from between his lips. Half an hour ago the world had reached out its arms to him, and he had gone forth to its welcome, only to have the grimmest tragedy of all his life descend upon him like the sword of Damocles. For this was real tragedy. Here there was no hope. The tentacles of the law had him in their grip, and he could no longer dream of escape. Ghastly was the thought that it was he, James Kent, who had supervised the building of these cells. Acquainted with every trick and stratagem of the prisoner plotting for his freedom, he had left no weak point in their structure. Again he clenched his hands, and in his soul he cursed Mercer, as he went to the little barred window that overlooked the river from his cell. The river was near now. He could hear the murmur of it. He could see its movement, and that movement, played upon by the stars, seemed now a writhing sort of almost noiseless laughter taunting him in his folly. He went back to his cot, and in his despair buried his face in his hands. In the half hour after that he did not raise his head. For the first time in his life he knew that he was beaten, so utterly beaten that he no more had the desire to fight, and his soul was dark with the chaos of the things he had lost. At last he opened his eyes to the blackness of his prison room, and he beheld a marvelous thing. Across the gloom of the cell lay a shaft of golden fire. It was the light of the rising moon coming through his little steel-barred window. To Kent it had crept into his cell like a living thing. He watched it, fascinated. His eyes followed it to the foot-square aperture, and there, red and glorious as it rose over the forests, the moon itself filled the world. For a space he saw nothing but that moon crowding the frame of his window. And as he rose to his feet and stood where his face was flooded in the light of it, he felt stirring within him the ghosts of his old hopes. One by one they rose up and came to life. He held out his hands as if to fill them with the liquid glow. His heart beat faster in that glory of the moonrise. The taunting murmur of the river changed once more into hopeful song. His fingers closed tightly around the bars, and the fighting spirit rose in him again. As that spirit surged stronger, beating down his despair, driving the chaos out of his brain, he watched the moon as it climbed higher, changing from the red of the lower atmosphere to the yellow gold of the greater heights, marveling at the miracle of light and color that had never failed to stir him. And then he laughed. If Pelly or Carter had heard him, they would have wondered if he was mad. It was madness of a sort, the madness of restored confidence, of an unlimited faith, of an optimism that was bound to make dreams come true. Again he looked beyond the bars of his cell. The world was still there, the river was there, all the things that were worth fighting for were there. And he would fight. Just how, he did not try to tell himself now. And then he laughed again, softly, a bit grimly, for he saw the melancholy humor of the fact that he had built his own prison. He sat down again on the edge of his cot, and the whimsical thought struck him that all those he had brought to the same cell, and who had paid the first of their penance here, must be laughing at him now in the spirit way. In his mental fancy, a little army of faces trooped before him, faces dark and white, faces filled with hatred and despair, faces brave with the cheer of hope, and faces pallid with the dread of death. And of these ghosts of his man-hunting prowess, it was Anton Fournet's face that came out of the crowd and remained with him. For he had brought Anton to this same cell. Anton, the big Frenchman, with his black hair, his black beard, and his great rolling laugh, that even in the days when he was waiting for death, had rattled the paperweights on Kedsty's desk. Anton rose up like a god before Kent now. He had killed a man, and like a brave man he had not denied it. With a heart in his great body as gentle as a girl's, Anton had taken pride in the killing. In his prison days he sang songs to glorify it. He had killed the white man from Chippewyan who had stolen his neighbor's wife. Not his wife, but his neighbor's. For Anton's creed was, "Do unto others as you would have others do unto you," and he had loved his neighbor with the great forest love of man for man. His neighbor was weak, and Anton was strong with the strength of a bull, so that when the hour came, it was Anton who had measured out vengeance. When Kent brought Anton in, the giant had laughed first at the littleness of his cell, then at the unsuspected strength of it, and after that he had laughed and sung great roaring songs every day of the brief tenure of life that was given him. When he died, it was with the smiling glory in his face of one who had cheaply righted a great wrong. Kent would never forget Anton Fournet. He had never ceased to grieve that it had been his misfortune to bring Anton in, and always, in close moments, the thought of Anton, the stout-hearted, rallied him back to courage. Never would he be the man that Anton Fournet had been, he told himself many times. Never would his heart be as great or as big, though the law had hanged Anton by the neck until the soul was choked out of his splendid body. For it was history that Anton Fournet had never harmed man, woman, or child until he set out to kill a human snake, and the law placed its heel upon him and crushed him. And tonight Anton Fournet came into the cell again and sat with Kent on the cot where he had slept many nights, and the ghosts of his laughter and his song filled Kent's ears, and his great courage poured itself out in the moonlit prison room, so that at last, when Kent stretched himself on the cot to sleep, it was with the knowledge that the soul of the splendid dead had given him a strength which it was impossible to have gained from the living. For Anton Fournet had died smiling, laughing, singing, and it was of Anton Fournet that he dreamed when he fell asleep. And in that dream came also the vision of a man called Dirty Fingers, and with it, inspiration. End of Chapter 10. Recording by Roger Moline. Chapter 11 of The Valley of Silent Men. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Roger Moline. The Valley of Silent Men by James Oliver Curwood. Chapter 11. Where a bit of the big river curved inward like the tongue of a friendly dog, lapping the shore at Athabasca Landing, there still remained Fingers Row, nine dilapidated, weather-worn, and crazily built shacks put there by the eccentric genius who had foreseen a boom 10 years ahead of its time. And the fifth of these nine, counting from either one end or the other, was named by its owner, Dirty Fingers himself, the Good Old Queen Bess. It was a shack covered with black tar paper, with two windows, like square eyes, fronting the river as if always on the watch for something. Across the front of this shack, Dirty Fingers had built a porch to protect himself from the rain in springtime, from the sun in summertime, and from the snow in the months of winter. For it was here that Dirty Fingers sat out all of that part of his life which was not spent in bed. Up and down 2,000 miles of the Three Rivers was Dirty Fingers known, and there were superstitious ones who believed that little gods and devils came to sit and commune with him in the front of his tar-papered shack. No one was so wise along those rivers, no one was so satisfied with himself, that he would not have given much to possess the many things that were hidden away in Dirty Fingers' brain. One would not have suspected the workings of that brain by a look at Dirty Fingers in the porch of his good old Queen Bess. He was a great, soft lump of a man, a giant of flabbiness. Sitting in his smooth-worn wooden armchair, he was almost formless. His head was huge, his hair uncut and scraggy, his face smooth as a baby's, fat as a cherub's, and as expressionless as an apple. His folded arms always rested on a huge stomach, whose conspicuousness was increased by an enormous watch-chain made from beaten nuggets of Klondike gold, and Dirty Fingers' thumb and forefingers were always twiddling at this chain. How he had come by the name of Dirty Fingers, when his right name was Alexander Toppet Fingers, no one could definitely say, unless it was that he always bore an unkempt and unwashed appearance. Whatever the quality of the 240-odd pounds of flesh in Dirty Fingers' body, it was the quality of his brain that made people hold him in a sort of awe. For Dirty Fingers was a lawyer, a wilderness lawyer, a forest bencher, a legal strategist of the trail, of the river, of the great timberlands. Stored away in his brain was every rule of equity and common law of the great North Country. For his knowledge, he went back 200 years. He knew that a law did not die of age, that it must be legislated to death, and out of the moldering past he had dug up every trick and trap of his trade. He had no law books. His library was in his head, and his facts were marshaled in pile after pile of closely written, dust-covered papers in his shack. He did not go to court as other lawyers, and there were barristers in Edmonton who blessed him for that. His shack was his tabernacle of justice. There he sat, hands folded, and gave out his decisions, his advice, his sentences. He sat until other men would have gone mad. From morning until night, moving only for his meals or to get out of the heat or storm, he was a fixture on the porch of the good old Queen Bess. For hours he would stare at the river, his pale eyes never seeming to blink. For hours he would remain without a move or a word. One constant companion he had, a dog, fat, emotionless, lazy, like his master. Always this dog was sleeping at his feet, or dragging himself wearily at his heels, when Dirty Fingers elected to make a journey to the little store where he bartered for food and necessities. It was Father Leon who came first to see Kent in his cell the morning after Kent's unsuccessful attempt at flight. An hour later, it was Father Leon who traveled the beaten path to the door of Dirty Fingers' shack. If a visible emotion of pleasure ever entered into Dirty Fingers' face, it was when the little missioner came occasionally to see him. It was then that his tongue let itself loose, and until late at night they talked of many things of which other men knew but little. This morning Father Leon did not come casually, but determinedly on business, and when Dirty Fingers learned what that business was, he shook his head disconsolately, folded his fat arms more tightly over his stomach, and stated the sheer impossibility of his going to see Kent. It was not his custom. People must come to him, and he did not like to walk. It was fully a third of a mile from his shack to barracks, possibly half a mile, and it was mostly upgrade. If Kent could be brought to him... In his cell, Kent waited. It was not difficult for him to hear voices in Kedsty's office when the door was open, and he knew that the inspector did not come in until after the missioner had gone on its mission to Dirty Fingers. Usually he was at the barracks an hour or so earlier. Kent made no effort to figure out a reason for Kedsty's lateness, but he did observe that after his arrival there was more than the usual movement between the office door and the outside of the barracks. Once he was positive that he heard Cardigan's voice, and then he was equally sure that he heard Mercer's. He grinned at that. He must be wrong, for Mercer would be in no condition to talk for several days. He was glad that a turn in the hall hid the door of the detachment office from him, and that the three cells were in an alcove, safely out of sight of the curious eyes of visitors. He was also glad that he had no other prisoner for company. His situation was one in which he wanted to be alone. To the plan that was forming itself in his mind, solitude was as vital as the cooperation of Alexander Toppet Fingers. Just how far could he win that cooperation was the problem which confronted him now, and he waited anxiously for the return of Father Layonne, listening for the sound of his footsteps in the outer hall. If, after all, that inspirational thought of last night came to nothing, if Fingers should fail him... He shrugged his shoulders. If that happened, he could see no other chance. He would have to go on and take his medicine at the hands of a jury. But if Fingers played up to the game... He looked out on the river again, and again it was the river that seemed to answer him. If Fingers played with him, they would beat Kedsty in the whole of N Division. And in winning, he would prove out the greatest psychological experiment he had ever dared to make. The magnitude of the thing, when he stopped to think about it, was a little appalling, but his faith was equally large. He did not consider his philosophy at all supernatural. He had brought it down to the level of the average man and woman. He believed that every man and woman possessed a subliminal consciousness which it was possible to rouse to tremendous heights if the right psychological key was found to fit its particular lock, and he believed he possessed the key which fitted the deeply buried and long-hidden thing in Dirty Fingers' remarkable brain. Because he believed in this metaphysics which he had not read out of Aristotle, he had faith that Fingers would prove his salvation. He felt growing in him, stronger than ever, a strange kind of elation. He felt better physically than last night. The few minutes of strenuous action in which he had half-killed Mercer had been a pretty good test, he told himself. It had left no bad effect, and he need no longer fear the reopening of his wound. A dozen times he had heard a far door open and close. Now he heard it again, and a few moments later it was followed by a sound which drew a low cry of satisfaction from him. Dirty Fingers, because of overweight and lack of exercise, had what he called an asthmatic wind, and it was this strenuous working of his lungs that announced his approach to Kent. His dog was also afflicted, and for the same reasons, so that when they traveled together there was some rivalry between them. "We're both bad put out for wind, thank God," Dirty Fingers would say sometimes. "It's a good thing, for if we had more of it, we'd walk farther, and we don't like walking." The dog was with Fingers now, also Father Layonne and Pelly. Pelly unlocked the cell, then relocked it again after Fingers and the dog entered. With a nod and a hopeful look, the missioner returned with Pelly to the detachment office. Fingers wiped his red face with a big handkerchief, gasping deeply for breath. Toggs, his dog, was panting as if he had just finished the race of his life.
"A difficult climb," wheezed Fingers. "A most difficult climb."
He sat down, rolling out like a big bag of jelly in the one chair in the cell, and began to fan himself with his hat. Kent had already taken stock of the situation. In Fingers' florid countenance, and in his almost colorless eyes, he detected a bit of excitement which Fingers was trying to hide. Kent knew what it meant. Father Layonne had found it necessary to play his full hand to lure Fingers up the hill, and had given him a hint of what it was that Kent had in store for him. Already the psychological key had begun to work. Kent sat down on the edge of his cot and grinned sympathetically.
"It hasn't always been like this, has it, Fingers?" he said then, leaning a bit forward and speaking with a sudden, low-voiced seriousness. "There was a time, 20 years ago, when you didn't puff after climbing a hill. 20 years make a big difference sometimes."
"Yes, sometimes," agreed Fingers in a wheezy whisper.
20 years ago, you were a fighter."
It seemed to Kent that a deeper color came into Dirty Fingers' pale eyes in the few seconds that followed these words.
"A fighter," he repeated. "Most men were fighters in those days of the gold rushes, weren't they, Fingers? I've heard a lot of the old stories about them in my wanderings, and some of them have made me thrill. They weren't afraid to die, and most of them were pretty white when it came to a showdown. You were one of them, Fingers. I heard the story one winter far north. I've kept it to myself, because I've sort of had the idea that you didn't want people to know, or you would have told it yourself. That's why I wanted you to come to see me, Fingers. You know the situation. It's either the noose or iron bars for me. Naturally, one would seek for assistance among those who have been his friends. But I do not, with the exception of Father Layonne. Just friendship won't save me, not the sort of friendship we have today. That's why I sent for you. Don't think that I am prying into secrets that are sacred to you, Fingers. God knows I don't mean it that way. But I've got to tell you of a thing that happened a long time ago before you can understand. You haven't forgotten, you will never forget, Ben Tatman?" As Kent spoke the name, a name which Dirty Fingers had heard no lips but his own speak aloud in nearly a quarter of a century, a strange and potent force seemed suddenly to take possession of the forest bencher's huge and flabby body. It rippled over and through him like an electrical voltaism, making his body rigid, stiffening what had seemed to be fat into muscle, tensing his hands until they knotted themselves slowly into fists. The wheeze went out of his breath, and it was the voice of another man who answered Kent.
"You have heard about Ben Tatman?"
"Yes, I heard it away up in the Porcupine Country. They say it happened 20 years ago or more. This Tatman, so I was told, was a young fellow, green from San Francisco, a bank clerk, I think, who came into the gold country and brought his wife with him. They were both chuck full of courage, and the story was that each worshipped the ground the other walked on, and that the girl had insisted on being her husband's comrade in adventure. Of course, neither guessed the sort of thing that was ahead of them. Then came that death winter in Lost City. You know better than I what the laws were in those days, Fingers. Food failed to come up. Snow came early. The thermometer never rose over 50 below zero for 3 straight months, and Lost City was an inferno of starvation and death. You could go out and kill a man then, and perhaps get away with it, Fingers. But if you stole so much as a crust of bread or a single bean, you were taken to the edge of the camp and told to go. And that meant certain death, death from hunger and cold, more terrible than shooting or hanging, and for that reason it was the penalty for theft. Tatman wasn't a thief. It was seeing his young wife slowly dying of hunger, and his horror at the thought of seeing her fall, as others were falling, a victim to scurvy, that made him steal. He broke into a cabin in the dead of night and stole 2 cans of beans and a pan of potatoes, more precious than 1,000 times their weight in gold. And he was caught. Of course, there was the wife.
but those were the days when a woman couldn't save a man, no matter how lovely she was. Tatman was taken to the edge of camp and given his pack and his gun, but no food. And the girl, hooded and booted, was at his side, for she was determined to die with him. For her sake, Tatman had lied up to the last minute, protesting his innocence. But the beans and the potatoes were found in his cabin, and that was evidence enough. And then, just as they were about to go straight out into the blizzard that meant death within a few hours, then... Kent rose to his feet and walked to the little window, and stood there, looking out. Fingers, now and then a Superman is born on Earth. And a Superman was there in that crowd of hunger-stricken and embittered men. At the last moment, he stepped out, and in a loud voice declared that Tatman was innocent, and that he was guilty. Unafraid, he made a remarkable confession. He had stolen the beans and the potatoes, and had slipped them into the Tatman cabin when they were asleep. Why? Because he wanted to save the woman from hunger. Yes, he lied, Fingers. He lied because he loved the wife that belonged to another man. Lied because in him there was a heart as true as any heart God ever made. He lied, and his lie was a splendid thing. He went out into that blizzard, strengthened by a love that was greater than his fear of death, and the camp never heard of him again. Tatman and his wife returned to their cabin and lived. Fingers, Kent whirled suddenly from the window. Fingers, and Fingers, like a sphinx, sat and stared at Kent. You were that man, Kent went on, coming nearer to him. You lied because you loved a woman, and you went out to face death because of that woman. The men at Lost City didn't know it, Fingers. The husband didn't know it, and the girl, that girl-wife you worshipped in secret, didn't dream of it. But that was the truth, and you know it deep down in your soul. You fought your way out. You lived. And all these years, down here in your porch, you've been dreaming of a woman, of the girl you were willing to die for a long time ago. Fingers, am I right? And if I am, will you shake hands? Slowly, Fingers had risen from his chair. No longer were his eyes dull and lifeless, but flaming with a fire that Kent had lighted again after many years. And he reached out a hand and gripped Kent's, still staring at him as though something had come back to him from the dead. "I thank you, Kent, for your opinion of that man," he said. "Somehow you haven't made me ashamed. But it was only the shell of a man that won out that day when I took Tatman's place. Something happened. I don't know what. But you see me now. I never went back into the diggings. I degenerated. I became what I am." "And you are today just what you were when you went out to die for Mary Tatman," cried Kent. "The same heart and the same soul are in you. Wouldn't you fight again today for her?" A stifled cry came from Fingers' lips. "My God, yes, Kent, I would. And that's why I wanted you, of all men, to come to me, Fingers," Kent went on swiftly. "To you, of all the men on Earth, I wanted to tell my story. And now, will you listen to it? Will you forgive me for bringing up this memory that must be precious to you, only that you might more fully understand what I am going to say? I don't want you to think of it as a subterfuge on my part. It is more than that. It is, Fingers. Is it inspiration? Listen and tell me." And for a long time after that, James Kent talked, and Fingers listened, the soul within him writhing and dragging itself back into fierce life, demanding for the first time in many years the something which it had once possessed, but which it had lost. It was not the lazy, mysterious, silent Dirty Fingers who sat in the cell with Kent. In him, the spirit of 20 years ago had roused itself from long slumber, and the thrill of it pounded in his blood. Two-fisted Fingers, they had called him then, and he was Two-fisted Fingers in this hour with Kent. Twice Father Layonne came to the head of the cell alcove, but turned back when he heard the low and steady murmur of Kent's voice. Nothing did Kent keep hidden, and when he had finished, something that was like the fire of a revelation had come into Fingers' face.
"My God!" he breathed deeply. "Kent, I've been sitting down there on my porch a long time, and a good many strange things have come to me, but never anything like this. Oh, if it wasn't for this accursed flesh of mine!"
He jumped from his chair more quickly than he had moved in 10 years, and he laughed as he had not laughed in all that time. He thrust out a great arm and doubled it up, like a prize-fighter testing his muscle.
"Old? I'm not old. I was only 28 when that happened up there, and I'm 48 now. That isn't old. It's what's in me that's grown old. I'll do it, Kent. I'll do it, if I hang for it."
Kent fairly leaped upon him.
"God bless you!" he cried huskily. "God bless you, Fingers! Look! Look at that!"
He pulled Fingers to the little window, and together they looked out upon the river, shimmering gloriously under a sun-filled sky of blue.
2,000 miles of it," he breathed. 2,000 miles of it, running straight through the heart of that world we both have known. "No, you're not old, Fingers. The things you used to know are calling you again, as they are calling me, for somewhere off there are the ghosts of Lost City. Ghosts and realities."
"Ghosts and hopes," said Fingers.
"Hopes make life," softly whispered Kent, as if to himself. And then, without turning from the window, his hand found Fingers and clasped it tight.
"It may be that mine, like yours, will never come true. But they're fine to think about, Fingers. Funny, isn't it, that their names should be so strangely alike? Mary and Marette? I say, Fingers."
Heavy footsteps sounded in the hall. Both turned from the window as Constable Pelly came to the door of the cell. They recognized this intimation that their time was up, and with his foot, Fingers roused his sleeping dog. It was a new Fingers who walked back to the river 5 minutes later, and it was an amazed and discomfited dog who followed at his heels, for at times the misshapen and flesh-ridden Toggs was compelled to trot for a few steps to keep up. And Fingers did not sink into the chair on the shady porch when he reached his shack. He threw off his coat and waistcoat and rolled up his sleeves, and for hours after that he was buried deep in the accumulated masses of dust-covered legal treasures stored away in hidden corners of the good old Queen Bess. End of Chapter 11. Recording by Roger Moline. Chapter 12 of The Valley of Silent Men. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Roger Moline. The Valley of Silent Men by James Oliver Curwood. Chapter 12. That morning Kent had heard wild songs floating up from the river, and now he felt like shouting forth his own joy and exultation in song. He wondered if he could hide the truth from the eyes of others, and especially from Kedsty, if he came to see him. It seemed that some glimmer of the hope blazing within him must surely reveal itself, no matter how he tried to hold it back. He felt the vital forces of that hope more powerful within him now than in the hour when he had crept from the hospital window with freedom in his face. For then he was not sure of himself. He had not tested his physical strength. And in the present moment, fanned by his unbound optimism, the thought came to him that perhaps it was good luck, and not bad, that had thrown Mercer in his way. For with Fingers behind him now, his chances for a clean getaway were better. He would not be taking a hazardous leap chanced on the immediate smiles of fortune. He would be going deliberately, prepared. He blessed the man who had been known as Dirty Fingers, but whom he could not think of now in the terms of that name. He blessed the day he had heard that chance story of Fingers, far north. He no longer regarded him as the fat pig of a man he had been for so many years. For he looked upon the miracle of a great awakening. He had seen the soul of Fingers lift itself up out of its tabernacle of flesh and grow young again. He had seen stagnant blood race with new fire. He had seen emotions roused that had slept for long years. And he felt toward Fingers, in the face of that awakening, differently than he had felt toward any other living man. His emotion was one of deep and embracing comradeship. Father Leon did not come again until afternoon, and then he brought information that thrilled Kent. The missioner had walked down to see Fingers, and Fingers was not on his porch. Neither was the dog. He had knocked loudly on the door, but there was no answer. Where was Fingers? Kent shook his head, feigning an anxious questioning, but inside him his heart was leaping. He knew. He told Father Leon he was afraid all Fingers' knowledge of the law could do him but little good, that Fingers had told him as much, and the little missioner went away considerably depressed. He would talk with Fingers again, he said, and offer certain suggestions he had in mind. Kent chuckled when he was gone. How shocked Le Pere would be if he, too, could know. The next morning Father Leon came again, and his information was even more thrilling to Kent. The missioner was displeased with Fingers. Last night, noticing a light in his shack, he had walked down to see him, and he had found three men closely drawn up about a table with Dirty Fingers. One of them was Ponte, the half-breed. Another was Kinu, the outcast Dog Rib from over on Sand Creek. The third was Mui, the old Indian trailer. Kent wanted to jump up and shout, for those three were the three greatest trailers in all that part of the Northland. Fingers had lost no time, and he wanted to voice his approbation like a small boy on the 4th of July. But his face, seen by Father Leon, betrayed none of the excitement that was in his blood. Fingers had told him he was going into a timber deal with these men, a long-distance deal where there would be much traveling, and that he could not interrupt himself just then to talk about Kent. Would Father Leon come again in the morning? And he had gone again that morning, and Fingers' place was locked up. All the rest of the day Kent waited eagerly for Fingers. For the first time Kedsty came to see him, and as a matter of courtesy said he hoped Fingers might be of assistance to him. He did not mention Mercer, and remained no longer than a couple of minutes standing outside the cell. In the afternoon Dr. Cardigan came and shook hands warmly with Kent. He had found a tough job waiting for him, he said. Mercer was all cut up in a literal as well as a mental way. He had five teeth missing, and he had to have 17 stitches taken in his face. It was Cardigan's opinion that someone had given him a considerable beating, and he grinned at Kent. Then he added in a whisper, "My God, Kent, how I wish you had made it." It was 4 o'clock when Fingers came. Even less than yesterday did he look like the old Fingers. He was not wheezing. He seemed to have lost flesh. His face was alive. That was what struck Kent, the new life in it. There was color in his eyes. And Togs, the dog, was not with him. He smiled when he shook hands with Kent, and nodded and chuckled. And Kent, after that, gripped him by the shoulders and shook him in his silent joy.
"I was up all last night," said Fingers in a low voice. "I don't dare move much in the day, or people will wonder. But, God bless my soul, I did move last night, Kent. I must have walked 10 miles, more or less. And things are coming, coming. And Ponte, Canoe, Mui are working like devils," whispered Fingers. "It's the only way, Kent. I've gone through all my law, and there's nothing in man-made law that can save you. I've read your confession, and I don't think you could even get off with the penitentiary. A noose is already tied around your neck. I think you'd hang. We've simply got to get you out some other way. I've had a talk with Kedsty. He has made arrangements to have you sent to Edmonton 2 weeks from tomorrow. We'll need all that time, but it's enough." For 3 days thereafter, Fingers came to Kent's cell each afternoon, and each time was looking better. Something was swiftly putting hardness into his flesh and form into his body. The second day he told Kent that he had found the way at last, and that when the hour came, escape would be easy, but he thought it best not to let Kent in on the little secret just yet. He must be patient and have faith. That was the chief thing, to have faith at all times, no matter what happened. Several times he emphasized that, no matter what happens. The third day he puzzled Kent. He was restless, a bit nervous. He still thought it best not to tell Kent what his scheme was until tomorrow. He was in the cell not more than 5 or 10 minutes, and there was an unusual pressure in the grip of his hand when he bade Kent goodbye. Somehow, Kent did not feel so well when he had gone. He waited impatiently for the next day. It came, and hour after hour he listened for Fingers' heavy tread in the hall. The morning passed. The afternoon lengthened. Night came, and Fingers had not come. Kent did not sleep much between the hour when he went to bed and morning. It was 11 o'clock when the missioner made his call. Before he left, Kent gave him a brief note for Fingers. He had just finished his dinner, and Carter had taken the dishes away, when Father Léon returned. A look at his face, and Kent knew that he bore unpleasant tidings.
"Fingers is an apostate," he said, his lips twitching as if to keep back a denunciation still more emphatic. "He was sitting on his porch again this morning, half asleep, and says that after a great deal of thought, he has come to the definite opinion that he can do nothing for you. He read your note and burned it with a match. He asked me to tell you that the scheme he had in mind was too risky for him. He says he won't come up again, and—" The missioner was rubbing his brown, knotted hands together raspingly. "Go on," said Kent, a little thickly. "He has also sent Inspector Kedsty the same word," finished Father Léon. "His words to Kedsty is that he can see no fighting chance for you, and that it is useless effort on his part to put up a defense for you. Jimmy," his hand touched Kent's arm gently. Kent's face was white. He faced the window, and for a space he did not see. Then, with pencil and paper, he wrote again to Fingers. It was late in the afternoon before Father Léon returned with an answer. Again it was verbal. Fingers had read his note and had burned it with a match. He was particular that the last scrap of it was turned into ash, the missioner said, and he had nothing to say to Kent that he had not previously said. He simply could not go on with their plans. And he requested Kent not to write to him again. He was sorry, but that was his definite stand in the matter. Even then, Kent could not bring himself to believe.
All the rest of the day he tried to put himself in Fingers' brain, but his old trick of losing his personality in that of another failed him this time. He could find no reason for the sudden change in Fingers, unless it was that Fingers had frankly confessed to Father Layonne fear. The influence of mind, in this instance, had failed in its assault upon a mass of matter. Fingers' nerve had gone back on him. The fifth day, Kent rose from his cot with hope still not quite dead in his heart. But that day passed, and the sixth, and the missioner brought word that Fingers was the old dirty Fingers again, sitting from morning till night on his porch. On the seventh day came the final crash to Kent's hopes. Kedsty's program had changed. He, Kent, was to start for Edmonton the following morning, under charge of Pelly and a special constable. After this, Kent felt a strange change come over him. Years seemed to multiply themselves in his body. His mind, beaten back, no longer continued in its old channels of thought. The thing pressed upon him now as fatalistic. Fingers had failed him. Fortune had failed him. Everything had failed, and for the first time in the weeks of his struggle against death and a thing worse than death, he cursed himself. There was a limit to optimism and a limit to hope. His limit was reached. In the afternoon of this seventh day came a depressing gloom. It was filled with a drizzling rain. Hour after hour this drizzle kept up, thickening as the night came. He ate his supper by the light of a cell lamp. By 8 o'clock it was black outside. In that blackness there was an occasional flash of lightning and rumble of thunder. On the roof of the barracks the rain beat steadily and monotonously. His watch was in his hand. It was a quarter after 9 o'clock when he heard the door at the far exit of the hall open and close. He had heard it a dozen times since supper, and paid no attention to it, but this time it was followed by a voice at the detachment office that hit him like an electrical shock. Then, a moment later, came low laughter. It was a woman who laughed. He stood up. He heard the detachment office door close, and silence followed. The watch in his hand seemed ticking off the seconds with frantic noise. He shoved it into his pocket and stood staring out into the prison alcove. A few minutes later, the office door opened again. This time it was not closed. He heard distinctly a few light, hesitating footsteps, and his heart seemed to stop its beating. They came to the head of the lighted alcove, and for perhaps the space of a dozen seconds there was silence again. Then they advanced. Another moment, and Kent was staring through the bars into the glorious eyes of Marette Radisson. End of Chapter 12. Recording by Roger Moline. Chapter 13 of The Valley of Silent Men. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Roger Moline. The Valley of Silent Men by James Oliver Curwood. Chapter 13. In that moment Kent did not speak. He made no sound. He gave no sign of welcome, but stood in the middle of his cell, staring. If life had hung upon speech in those few seconds, he would have died, but everything he would have said, and more, was in his face. The girl must have seen it. With her two hands she was gripping at the bars of the cell and looking through at him. Kent saw that her face was pale in the lamp glow. In that pallor her violet eyes were like pools of black. The hood of her dripping raincoat was thrown partly back, and against the whiteness of her cheeks her hair glistened wet, and her long lashes were heavy with the rain. Kent, without moving over the narrow space between them, reached out his hands and found his voice.
"Marette!"
Her hands had tightened about the bars until they were bloodless. Her lips were parted. She was breathing quickly, but she did not smile. She made no response to his greeting, gave no sign even of recognition. What happened after that was so sudden and amazing that his heart stopped dead still. Without warning, she stepped back from the cell and began to scream, and then drew away from him, still facing him and still screaming as if something had terrified her. Kent heard the crash of a chair in the detachment office, excited voices, and the running of feet. Marette Radisson had withdrawn to the far corner of the alcove, and as Carter and Pelly ran toward her, she stood, a picture of horror, pointing at Kent's cell. The two constables rushed past her. Close behind them followed the special officer detailed to take Kent to Edmonton. Kent had not moved. He was like one petrified. Close up against the bars came the faces of Pelly, Carter, and the special constable, filled with the expressions of men who had expected to look in upon tragedy. And then, behind their backs, Kent saw the other thing happen. Swift as a flash, Marette Radisson's hand went in and out of her raincoat, and at the backs of the three men she was leveling a revolver. Not only did Kent see that swift change, but the still swifter change that came into her face. Her eyes shot to his just once, and they were filled with a laughing, exultant fire. With one mighty throb, Kent's heart seemed to leap out through the bars of his prison, and at the look in his face and eyes, Carter swung suddenly around.
"Please don't make any disturbance, gentlemen," said Marette Radisson. "The first man that makes a suspicious move I shall kill."
Her voice was calm and thrilling. It had a deadly ring in it. The revolver in her hand was held steadily. It was a slim-barreled black thing. The very color of it was menacing. And behind it were the girl's eyes, pools of flame. The three men were facing them now, shocked to speechlessness. Automatically they seemed to obey her command to throw up their hands. Then she leveled her grim little gun straight at Pelly's heart.
"You have the key," she said. "Unlock the cell."
Pelly fumbled and produced the key. She watched him closely. Then suddenly the special constable dropped his arm with a coarse laugh.
"A pretty trick," he said, "but the bluff won't work."
"Oh, but it will,"
came the reply. The little black gun was shifted to him, even as the constable's fingers touched his revolver holster. With half-smiling lips, Marette's eyes blazed at him.
"Please put up your hands," she commanded.
The constable hesitated, then his fingers gripped the butt of his gun. Kent, holding his breath, saw the almost imperceptible tensing of Marette's body and the wavering of Pelly's arms over his head. Another moment, and he, too, would have called the bluff, if it were that. But that moment did not come. From the slim, black barrel of the girl's revolver leaped forth a sudden spurt of smoke and flame, and the special constable lurched back against the cell bars, caught himself as he half fell, and then stood with his pistol arm hanging limp and useless at his side. He had not made a sound, but his face was twisted in pain.
"Open the cell door!"
A second time, the deadly-looking little gun was pointed straight at Pelly's heart. The half-smile was gone from the girl's lips now. Her eyes blazed a deeper fire. She was breathing quickly, and she leaned a little toward Pelly, repeating her command. The words were partly drowned in a sudden crash of thunder. But Pelly understood. He saw her lips form the words, and half heard, "Open the door, or I shall kill you." He no longer hesitated. The key grated in the lock, and Kent himself flung the door wide open and sprang out. He was quick to see and seize upon opportunity and swift to act. The astounding audacity of the girl's ruse, her clever acting in feigning horror to line the guards up at the cell door, and the thrilling decisiveness with which she had used the little black gun in her hand, sent every drop of blood in his body afire. No sooner was he outside his cell than he was the old Jim Kent, fighting man. He whipped Carter's automatic out of its holster, and covering Pelly and the special constable, relieved them of their guns. Behind him he heard Marette's voice, calm and triumphant,
"Lock them in the cell, Mr. Kent."
He did not look at her, but swung his gun on Pelly and the special constable, and they backed through the door into the cell. Carter had not moved. He was looking straight at the girl, and the little black gun was leveled at his breast. Pelly and the wounded man did not see, but on Carter's lips was a strange smile. His eyes met Kent's, and there was revealed for an instant a silent flash of comradeship and an unmistakable something else. Carter was glad. It made Kent want to reach out and grip his hand, but in place of that he backed him into the cell, turned the key in the lock, and with the key in his hand, faced Marette Radisson. Her eyes were shining gloriously. He had never seen such splendid fighting eyes, nor the bird-like swiftness with which she turned and ran down the hall, calling him to follow her. He was only a step behind her in passing Kedsty's office. She reached the outer door and opened it. It was pitch dark outside, and a deluge of rain beat into their faces. He observed that she did not replace the hood of her raincoat when she darted out. As he closed the door, her hand groped to his arm, and from that found his hand. Her fingers clung to his tightly. He did not ask questions as they faced the black chaos of rain. A rending streak of lightning revealed her for an instant, her bare head bowed to the wind. Then came a crash of thunder that shook the earth under their feet, and her fingers closed more tightly about his hand. And in that crash he heard her voice, half laughing, half broken, saying, "I'm afraid of thunder." In that storm his laugh rang out, a great, free, joyous laugh. He wanted to stop in that instant, sweep her up into his arms, and carry her. He wanted to shout like an insane man in his mad joy. And a moment before she had risked everything in facing three of the bravest men in the service, and had shot one of them. He started to say something, but she increased her speed until she was almost running. She was not leading Jim in the direction of the river, but toward the forest beyond Kedsty's bungalow. Not for an instant did she falter in that drenched and impenetrable darkness. There was something imperative in the clasp of her fingers, even though they tightened perceptibly when the thunder crashed. They gave Kent the conviction that there was no doubt in her mind as to the point she was striving for. He took advantage of the lightning, for each time it gave him a glimpse of her bare, wet head bowed to the storm, her white profile, and her slim figure fighting over the sticky earth under her feet. It was this presence of her, and not the thought of escape, that excited him now. She was at his side. Her hand lay close in his. The lightning gave him glimpses of her. He felt the touch of her shoulder, her arm, her body, as they drew close together. The life and warmth and thrill of her seemed to leap into his own veins through the hand he held. He had dreamed of her, and now, suddenly, she had become a part of him, and the glory of it rode overwhelmingly over all other emotions that were struggling in his brain. The glory of the thought that it was she who had come to him in the last moment, who had saved him, and who was now leading him to freedom through the crash of storm. At the crest of a low knoll between Barracks and Kedsty's bungalow, she stopped for the first time. He had there again the almost irresistible impulse to reach out in the darkness and take her into his arms, crying out to her of his joy, of a happiness that had come to him greater even than the happiness of freedom. But he stood, holding her hand, his tongue speechless, and he was looking at her when the lightning revealed her again. In a rending flash it cut open the night so close that the hiss of it was like the passing of a giant rocket, and involuntarily she shrank against him, and her free hand caught his arm at the instant thunder crashed low over their heads. His own hand groped out, and in the blackness it touched for an instant her wet face and then her drenched hair.
"Marette," he cried, "where are we going?"
"Down there," came her voice.
Her hand had left his arm, and he sensed that she was pointing, though he could not see. Ahead of them was a chaotic pit of gloom, a sea of blackness, and in the heart of that sea he saw a light. He knew that it was a lamp in one of Kedsty's windows, and that Marette was guiding herself by that light when she started down the slope with her hand still in his. That she had made no effort to withdraw it made him unconscious of the almost drowning discomfort of the fresh deluge of rain that beat their faces. One of her fingers had gripped itself convulsively about his thumb, like a child afraid of falling. And each time the thunder crashed, that soft hold on his thumb tightened, and Kent's soul acclaimed. They drew swiftly nearer to the light, for it was not far from the knoll to Kedsty's place. Kent's mind leaped ahead. A little west by north from the inspector's bungalow was Kim's Bayou, and it was undoubtedly to the forest trail over which he had gone at least once before, on the night of the mysterious assault upon Mooy, that Marette was leading him. Questions began to rush upon him now, immediate, demanding questions. They were going to the river. They must be going to the river. It was the quickest and surest way of escape. Had Marette prepared for that? And was she going with him? He had no time to answer. Their feet struck the gravel path leading to the door of Kedsty's place, and straight up this path the girl turned, straight toward the light blazing in the window. Then, to his amazement, he heard in the sweep of storm her voice crying out in glad triumph, "We're home!" Home! His breath came in a sudden gulp. He was more than astounded. He was shocked. Was she mad, or playing an amazingly improper joke? She had freed him from a cell to lead him to the home of the inspector of police, the deadliest enemy the world now held for him. He stopped, and Marette Radisson tugged at his hand, pulling him after her, insisting that he follow. She was clutching his thumb as though she thought he might attempt to escape.
"It is safe, Monsieur Jeems," she cried. "Don't be afraid."
"Monsieur Jeems!" And the laughing note of mockery in her voice. He rallied himself and followed her up the three steps to the door. Her hand found the latch, the door opened, and swiftly they were inside. The lamp in the window was close to them, but for a space he could not see because of the water in his eyes. He blinked it out, drew a hand across his face, and looked at Marette. She stood three or four paces from him. Her face was very white, and she was panting as if hard run for breath. But her eyes were shining, and she was smiling at him. The water was running from her in streams.
"You are wet," she said, "and I am afraid you will catch cold. Come with me."
Again she was making fun of him, just as she had made fun of him at Cardigan's. She turned, and he ran upstairs behind her. At the top she waited for him, and as he came up she reached out her hand, as if apologizing for having taken it from him when they entered the bungalow. He held it again as she led him down the hall to a door farthest from the stair. This she opened, and they entered. It was dark inside, and the girl withdrew her hand again, and Kent heard her moving across the room. In that darkness, a new and thrilling emotion possessed him. The air he was breathing was not the air he had breathed in the hall. In it was the sweet scent of flowers, and of something else, the faint and intangible perfume of a woman's room. He waited, staring. His eyes were wide when a match leaped into flame in Marette's fingers. Then he stood in the glow of a lamp. He continued to stare in the stupidity of a shock to which he was not accustomed. Marette, as if to give him time to acquaint himself with his environment, was taking off her raincoat. Under it, her slim little figure was dry, except where the water had run down from her uncovered head to her shoulders. He noticed that she wore a short skirt and boots, adorably small boots of splendidly worked caribou. And then, suddenly, she came toward him with both hands reaching out to him. "Please shake hands and say you're glad," she said. "Don't look so frightened. This is my room, and you are safe here." He held her hands tight, staring into the wonderful violet eyes that were looking at him with the frank and unembarrassed directness of a child's. "I don't understand," he struggled. "Marette, where is Kedsty?"
"He should be returning very soon."
"And he knows you are here, of course?" She nodded.
"I have been here for a month."
Kent's hands closed tightly about hers. I don't understand," he repeated. "Tonight Kedsty will know that it was you who rescued me, and you who shot Constable Willis. Good God, we must lose no time in getting away."
"There is great reason why Kedsty dare not betray my presence in his house," she said quietly. "He would die first, and he will not suspect that I have brought you to my room, that an escaped murderer is hiding under the very roof of the inspector of police. They will search for you everywhere but here. Isn't it splendid? He planned it all, every move, even to the screaming in front of your cell."
"You mean Kedsty?" She withdrew her hands and stepped back from him, and again he saw in her eyes a flash of the fire that had come into them when she leveled her gun at the three men in the prison alcove.
"No, not Kedsty. He would hang you, and he would kill me if he dared. I mean that great, big, funny-looking friend of yours, Monsieur Fingers."
End of chapter 13. Recording by Roger Moline. Chapter 14 of The Valley of Silent Men. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Roger Moline. The Valley of Silent Men by James Oliver Curwood. Chapter 14. The manner in which Kent stared at Marat Radisson after her announcement that it was Dirty Fingers who had planned his escape must have been, he thought afterward, little less than imbecile. He had wronged Fingers, he believed. He had called him a coward and a backslider. In his mind he had reviled him for helping to raise his hopes to the highest pitch, only to smash them in the end. And all the time Dirty Fingers had been planning this. Kent began to grin. The thing was clear in a moment, that is, the immediate situation was clear, or he thought it was. But there were questions. 1, 10, 100 of them. They wanted to pile over the end of his tongue, questions that had little or nothing to do with Kedsty. He saw nothing now but Marette. She had begun to take down her hair. It fell about her in wet, shining masses. Kent had never seen anything like it. It clung to her face, her neck, her shoulders and arms, and shrouded her slender body to her hips, lovely in its confusion. Little drops of water glistened in it like diamonds in the lamp glow, trickling down and dropping to the floor. It was like a glowing coat of velvety sable beaten by storm. Marette ran her arms up through it, shaking it out in clouds, and a mist of rain leaped out from it, some of it striking Kent in the face. He forgot Fingers. He forgot Kedsty. His brain flamed only with the electrifying nearness of her. It was the thought of her that had inspired the greatest hope in him. It was his dreams of her, somewhere on the big river, that had given him his great courage to believe in the ultimate of things. And now time and space had taken a leap backward. She was not 400 or 500 miles north. There was no long quest ahead of him. She was here, within a few feet of him, tossing the wet from that glorious hair he had yearned to touch, brushing it out now, with her back toward him, in front of her mirror. And as he sat there, uttering no word, looking at her, the demands of the immense responsibility that had fallen upon him and of the great fight that lay ahead pounded within him with naked fists. Fingers had planned. She had executed. It was up to him to finish. He saw her not as a creature to win, but as a priceless possession. Her fight had now become his fight. The rain was beating against the window near him. Out there was blackness, the river, the big world. His blood leaped with the old fighting fire. They were going tonight. They must be going tonight. Why should they wait? Why should they waste time under Kedsty's roof when freedom lay out there for the taking? He watched the swift movements of her hand, listened to the silken rustle of the brush as it smoothed out her long hair. Bewilderment, reason, desire for action fought inside him. Suddenly she faced him again. "It has just this moment occurred to me," she said, "that you haven't said thank you." So suddenly that he startled her, he was at her side. He did not hesitate this time, as he had hesitated in his room at Cardigan's place. He caught her two hands in his, and with them he felt the soft, damp crush of her hair between his fingers. Words tumbled from his lips. He could not remember afterward all that he said. Her eyes widened, and they never for an instant left his own. Thank her! He told her what had happened to him, in the heart and soul of him, from the hour she had come to him at Cardigan's. He told her of dreams and plans, of his determination to find her again after he had escaped, if it took him all his life. He told her of Mercer, of his discovery of her visit to Kim's Bayou, of his scheme to follow her down the Three Rivers, to seek for her at Fort Simpson, to follow her to the Valley of Silent Men, wherever it was. Thank her! He held her hands so tight they hurt, and his voice trembled. Under the cloud of her hair, a slow fire burned in Marette Radisson's cheeks, but it did not show in her eyes. They looked at him so steadily, so unfalteringly, that his own face burned before he had finished what was in his mind to say, and he freed her hands and stepped back from her again.
"Forgive me for saying all that," he entreated, "but it's true. You came to me there, at Cardigan's place, like something I'd always dreamed about, but never expected to find. And you came to me again, at the cell, like—"
"Yes, I know how I came," she interrupted him. "Through the mud and the rain, Mr. Kent. And it was so black I lost my way and was terrified to think that I might not find barracks. I was half an hour behind Mr. Finger's schedule. For that reason, I think Inspector Kedsty may return at any moment, and you must not talk so loud, or so much."
"Lord,"
he breathed in a whisper. "I have said a lot in a short time, haven't I? But it isn't a hundredth part of what I want to get out of my system. I won't ask the million questions that want to be asked, but I must know why we are here. Why have we come to Kedsty's? Why didn't we make for the river? There couldn't be a better night to get away."
"But it is not so good as the fifth night from now will be," she said, resuming the task of drying her hair. "On that night you may go to the river. Our plans were a little upset, you know, by Inspector Kedsty's change in the date on which you were to leave for Edmonton. Arrangements have been made so that on the fifth night you may leave safely."
"And you?"
"I shall remain here." And then she added in a low voice that struck his heart cold, "I shall remain to pay Kedsty the price which he will ask for what has happened tonight."
"Good God!" he cried. "Marette!" She turned on him swiftly.
"No, no, I don't mean that he will hurt me," she cried, a fierce little note in her voice. "I would kill him before that. I'm sorry I told you, but you must not question me. You shall not." She was trembling. He had never seen her excited like that before, and as she stood there before him, he knew that he was not afraid for her in the way that had flashed into his mind. She had not spoken empty words. She would fight. She would kill, if it was necessary to kill. And he saw her, all at once, as he had not seen her before. He remembered a painting which he had seen a long time ago in Montreal. It was L'Esprit de la Solitude, the Spirit of the Wild, painted by Conne, the picturesque French-Canadian friend of Lord Strathcona and Mount Royal, and a genius of the far backwoods who had drawn his inspiration from the heart of the wilderness itself. And that painting stood before him now in flesh and blood, its crudeness gone, but the marvelous spirit it had breathed remaining. Shrouded in her tumbled hair, her lips a little parted, every line of her slender body vibrant with an emotion which seemed consuming her, her beautiful eyes aglow with its fire, he saw in her, as Conn must have seen at another time, the soul of the great North itself. She seemed to him to breathe of the God's country far down the Three Rivers, of its almost savage fearlessness, its beauty, its sunshine, and its storm, its tragedy, its pathos, and its song. In her was the courage and the glory of that North. He had seen, and now he felt these things, and the thrill of them swept over him like an inundation. He had heard her soft laugh. She had made fun of him when he thought he was dying. She had kissed him. She had fought for him. She had clung in terror to his hand when the lightning flashed. And now she stood with her little hands clenched in her hair, like a storm about to break. A moment ago she was so near that he had almost taken her in his arms. Now, in an instant, she had placed something so vast between them that he would not have dared to touch her hand or her hair. Like sun and cloud and wind, she changed, and for him each change added to the wonder of her. And now it was storm. He saw it in her eyes, her hands, her body. He felt the electrical nearness of it in those low-spoken, trembling words, "You shall not!" The room seemed surcharged for a moment with impending shock. And then his physical eyes took in again the slimness of her, seized upon the alluring smallness of her, and the fact that he could have tossed her to the ceiling without great effort. And yet he saw her as one sees a goddess.
"No, I won't ask you questions when you look at me like that," he said, finding his tongue. "I won't ask you what this price is that Kedsty may demand, because you're not going to pay it. If you won't go with me, I won't go. I'd rather stay here and be hung. I'm not asking you questions, so please don't shoot, but if you told me the truth, and you belong in the North,
You're going back with me, or I'm not going. I'll not budge an inch." She drew a deep breath, as if something had greatly relieved her. Again her violet eyes came out from the shadow into sunlight, and her trembling mouth suddenly broke into a smile. It was not apologetic. There was about it a quick and spontaneous gladness which she made no effort at all to conceal.
"That is nice of you," she said. "I'm glad to hear you say it. I never knew how pleasant it was to have someone who was willing to be hung for me. But you will go, and I will not go. There isn't time to explain all about it just now, for Inspector Kedsty will be here very soon, and I must dry my hair and show you your hiding place, if you have to hide."
She began to brush her hair again. In the mirror, Kent caught a glimpse of the smile still trembling on her lips.
"I'm not questioning you," he guarded himself again, "but if you could only understand how anxious I am to know where Kedsty is, how Fingers found you, why you made us believe you were leaving the landing and then returned, and how badly I want to know something about you. I almost believe you'd talk a little while you were drying your hair."
"It was Mooey, the old Indian," she said. "It was he who found out in some way that I was here, and then Monsieur Fingers came himself one night when the inspector was away, got in through a window, and simply said that you had sent him, when I was just about to shoot him. You see, I knew you weren't going to die. Kedsty had told me that. I was going to help you in another way, if Monsieur Fingers hadn't come. Inspector Kedsty was over there tonight, at his cabin, when the thing happened down there. It was a part of Fingers' scheme to keep him out of the way."
Suddenly she grew rigid. The brush remained poised in her hair. Kent, too, heard the sound that she had heard. It was a loud tapping at one of the curtained windows, the tapping of some metallic object. And that window was 15 feet above the ground. With a little cry, the girl threw down her brush, ran to the window, and raised and lowered the curtain once. Then she turned to Kent, swiftly dividing her hair into thick strands and weaving them into a braid.
"It is Mooey!" she cried. "Kedsty is coming!"
She caught his hand and hurried him toward the head of the bed, where two long curtains were strung on a wire. She drew these apart. Behind them were what seemed to Kent an innumerable number of feminine garments.
"You must hide in them if you have to," she said, the excited little tremble in her voice again. "I don't think it will come to that, but if it does, you must. Bury yourself way back in them and keep quiet. If Kedsty finds you are here..."
She looked into his eyes, and it seemed to Kent that there was something which was very near to fear in them now.
"If he should find you here, it would mean something terrible for me," she went on, her hands creeping to his arms. "I cannot tell you what it is now, but it would be worse than death. Will you promise to stay here, no matter what happens down there, no matter what you may hear? Will you, Mr. Kent?"
"Not if you call me Mr. Kent," he said, something thickening in his throat.
"Will you, Jeems? Will you, no matter what happens, if I promise, when I come back, to kiss you?"
Her hands slipped almost caressingly from his arms, and then she had turned swiftly and was gone through the partly open door, closing it after her, before he could give his promise. End of Chapter 14. Recording by Roger Moline.
Shop the Sherwin-Williams Labor Day Sale and get 35% off paints and stains August 22nd through September 4th. With prices starting at $31.84, it's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Whether you're looking to revamp your interior or exterior, we have you covered with bold hues, soothing neutrals, and everything in between. Visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store or shop the sale online. Delivery available on qualifying orders. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.